We're joining Kip Wheadle of North Newton, Kansas at his home today.
Edith Wharton's 1923 novel, A Son at the Front, is not among her classics. So not being a regular Wharton reader, I didn't know much about it going in. Early in the novel, when her protagonist John Campton made dismissive comments about a war that at that point seemed imminent, I thought I might be reading an anti-war novel or even a defense of conscientious objection. But A Son at the Front isn't like that. Campton was not a conscientious objector. In fact, like so many Wharton characters, he wasn't all that conscientious about anything. To him, the war was a gigantic personal inconvenience. First, it took his son, George, from his side, and he didn't like that. Then it forced him to deal with his terrified ex-wife, George's mother, and her oh-so-bourgeois second husband. Then it started plucking away his friends, whom he missed, even when they weren't getting killed. To those left in Paris, or at least to those in the wealthy expatriate circles that John knew, the war was either something distant from which to hold oneself aloof, or once that became impossible, something to contribute to in fashionable ways, like making speeches about German atrocities or raising funds for displaced refugees. Let's compare John and his friends to the real people who opposed World War I on principled grounds. Conscientious objectors were barely tolerated. In the United States, wartime federal legislation recognized that conscientious objection could exist, but it approached with skepticism anyone who claimed it referred to them. In effect, it required them to pass two tests. First, it required that their objection be based on religious grounds and that the individual in question belonged to what the government called a well-recognized sect or organization whose creed or principles opposed war categorically. Members of the historic peace churches, like the Quakers, the Mennonites, and the Church of the Brethren, were most likely to pass this first test. But members of other churches had a harder time of it, and those who opposed the war on secular philosophical grounds were regarded as having no argument at all. Likewise, those who did not reject war categorically, but simply opposed Woodrow Wilson's policies, in other words, who didn't oppose all war but did oppose this war, were not regarded as having a conscientious objection. Even when someone passed this first test, there remained a second. A would-be conscientious objector also had to convince a civilian court of inquiry that his beliefs were sincere. The limitations the government placed on conscientious objection, the fact that some of those grounds had to do with a person's group membership rather than personal beliefs, and the questionable assumption that the seriousness of an individual's convictions could be measured by a panel of strangers, drew attention to the importance of individual civil liberties in wartime. It's not an accident that organizations such as the American Friends Service Committee and what eventually became the American Civil Liberties Union arose in an effort to defend the opponents of World War I. I suspect the grumbling, the tenuousness, and even the selfishness with which the men and women of A Son at the Front approached the war reflected the attitudes of the wealthy expatriates Wharton knew. They may even have reflected some of her own views. On the one hand, they eventually recognized the war as the human tragedy it was, but on the other hand, they loved France and its cultural presumption so much they couldn't extricate themselves from its martial spirit. Few people could, and that itself was part of the war's tragedy.
Thanks to Kip Wheadle, historian of North Newton, Kansas, for the HPPR Radio Readers Book Club. Mm-hmm.